This is the Psychology Forum. My name is Patrick O'Reilly, and I'm absolutely delighted to introduce our speaker for tonight. I've heard him speak on multiple occasions. He's a wonderful speaker. He's an associate. Sheldon Helms is an associate professor of psychology at Ohlone College, as well as the faculty advisor to the Psychology Club, through which he runs their very successful speaker series, hosting top-name psychologists, authors, and other leaders from the field of science and skepticism. In addition to his teaching responsibility, Sheldon serves as vice president of Beria Skeptics, a wonderful organization, by the way, that I recommend, one of the oldest and longest-running skeptical organizations in the state. He is also the host of the weekly science and skepticism podcast, Shell Shocked, which is available free of charge on iTunes and Stitcher. And he gives public talks on various topics related to psychology and critical thinking. Tonight, Sheldon's presentation will concentrate on some of the areas of psychology that promote ideas that are not supported by good scientific evidence, and will offer advice about how to put the sciences back into the behavioral sciences. So please welcome Sheldon Helms.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming out. Can I just have a quick show of hands? Who of you are working within the behavioral sciences in any way, teaching practitioners or anything? My people. Okay, good. So it's particularly important then that I start out by apologizing. And what I mean by that is my talk tonight is not meant in any way to denigrate the field of psychology whatsoever. As Patrick said, I've been teaching psychology for about 18 years now, and I just love it. I'm certainly not denigrating psychology or trying to get people to stay away from the field of psychology. On the contrary, I teach undergraduate students for the very reason that is the opposite of that, which is to get them involved in psychology, whether professionally or just personally. And I see my own skepticism through the lens of the behavioral sciences. So it's very important for me to start out there. My presentation instead is meant to try to take up for the field of psychology, because I see that my field that I love and think is very important to all of us, whether you ever take a psychology class or not, is being made less scientific by the day. This is particularly easy talk to put together, as a matter of fact, because you have an entire smorgasbord of examples of pseudoscience within the field of psychology. We're not alone in this. Pretty much any science you go into, there's some form of pseudoscience involved in it. Engineering. There are people within engineering who are trained engineers who help out those who question the 9/11 World Trade Center collapse. We call them 9/11 truthers. Within medicine, we have homeopathy, which is basically you're taking magic water instead of medicine. In the field of anthropology, we have creationists, some of whom believe the entire universe is only 6,000 years old. That's around the time, by the way, that the Sumerians invented glue, so they must have been very surprised indeed to look up and see the universe forming around them as they were inventing this glue. So we're not alone in that. However, there are studies that show that the field of psychology is unique in certain ways. We're particularly unique in the degree to which these fringe ideas infiltrate the mainstream of psychology. Some of them are even taught in psychology textbooks, and some of them frighteningly even make their way into the practicum of psychology and psychotherapy. So this is frightening to me, and it's of great concern. This is a talk on psychological pseudoscience, so it probably makes sense that first I give you a working definition of what I mean when I say pseudoscience. So here goes. Pseudoscience is a claim, belief, or practice that is presented as scientific but doesn't adhere to valid scientific method, lacks supporting evidence or plausibility, cannot be reliably tested, or otherwise lacks scientific status. So it has four main components. The first one is the use of vague, contradictory, exaggerated, or unprovable claims. The second is an over-reliance on confirmation rather than rigorous attempts at refutation. The third of the four is a lack of openness to evaluation by other experts within or outside the field. And lastly, a general absence of systematic processes to rationally develop theories. So this is what we mean when we say pseudoscience. As I said, like any field, we have pseudoscience. To give you an idea of the scope of the problem, I'm going to talk in three different sections in this hour or so. In the first one, I'm going to talk to you about fringe psychology. These are ideas and techniques that gain a following within the field of psychology, but they lack a basis for effectiveness and they lack a scientific backing. I'll be using some examples from fringe psychotherapy that many of you probably have never heard of. The fact that you haven't heard of them, though, doesn't necessarily mean that they're not damaging in some ways or dangerous. Next, I'll talk about mainstream psychology, singling out one in particular for a particularly close examination. These are the sorts of pseudoscientific concepts that most people in our culture have heard of before, but they may not realize that they're misconstrued or misunderstood in some way. They hold beliefs about them that are in contradiction to the actual research findings. And lastly, I included a section that's somewhat controversial that I call bad teaching as pseudoscience. And what I try to do here is demonstrate to you that teachers themselves, even people who teach psychology, can create misinformation, misunderstanding, and spread untruths. The reason for that is sometimes they don't understand the implications of even the classic studies within psychology, and I think that's something we need to fix. So let's start out with fringe psychology. Beginning around the 1960s and directly related to the cultural shifts that were happening in the Western world during that time, a veritable explosion of new psychotherapy started happening. Now, I think that probably we would all agree that a lot of that had more to do with distancing themselves from these stiff, stilted old Freudian ideas that were around then. These are certainly not your father's psychotherapy. They included things like rebirthing therapy, in which you literally are wrapped in a blanket, which is supposed to be an artificial vagina, and you are then expelled and literally reborn, or I should say figuratively reborn. This is not only not therapeutic, it also can be dangerous. There actually have been cases where children were suffocated to death using this procedure. Of course, it's a very extreme form of this procedure, but still, we would certainly want to regulate that if we could. We also have aromatherapy. We all recognize that it's nice to smell nice things. It's not going to cure your schizophrenia. It's probably not going to help you out with your clinical depression. But the idea seems sound at first, right? And then we have really bizarre things like primal scream therapy. I don't even know what to say about that. I guess it's supposed to be some kind of catharsis, you know, the idea of getting it out of your system, but there's no science behind any of these, really. That doesn't seem to matter to some people, but the good news is that these are usually short-lived. They don't really make much of a blip on the screen. Some, however, have. Fringe psychotherapies such as the ones that try to address serious problems. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a very serious issue, as probably many of you are aware. It's an anxiety disorder. And it's an anxiety disorder that involves extreme emotional trauma, usually involving death or injury or violence or at least the threat of one of those. And the symptoms are things like flashbacks to the event, profound, overwhelming, crippling anxiety, hypervigilance, and a host of other psychological and emotional problems. Since the fringe psychotherapies I'm going to discuss in this next section are promoted and often utilized as treatments for PTSD, and because this is such a serious psychological problem, I thought I would discuss a couple of those. Now, you should know that PTSD is treatable, and it's treatable with a very solid foundation psychotherapy called cognitive behavior therapy. I have the utmost respect for cognitive behavior therapy. Cognitive behavior therapy, if you're not aware, it uses the modalities of cognitive psychology and behavioral psychology. Obviously, from the name, you know that. But there are really three components to it. One of them is exposure, which is real or imagined exposure to the trigger stimulus. What this does for people is it allows them in a safer environment to be exposed to the trigger so that the trigger will eventually have less and less effect on them. It will be less of a triggering experience. And that could be an object, a situation, a memory of some kind, a thought, or whatever. Cognitive therapy, which involves engaging your client in Socratic dialogue, which challenges the thought processes that then lead them to the emotional response, and also anxiety management training, which can be also called stress inoculation. This includes relaxation training, breathing retraining, psychoeducation, and also self-instruction, so that once you leave the therapeutic realm, then you can self-coach. So cognitive behavior therapy is a great psychotherapy, and it stands in stark contrast to things like this. This is EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is a mouthful, so I'll just say EMDR from now on. It was invented by this woman, Dr. Francine Shapiro, and she used the phenomenological approach to start studying this. Now, phenomenological approach simply means some phenomenon happened to you, and you take that, and then you move on from there and hopefully get some scientific basis for it. Well, she had the phenomenon, and she had the idea, but I think she's lacking in the scientific area. That hasn't stopped her from being very successful, however. So here's the story behind EMDR. Francine Shapiro says she was on a walk one day and that she had a particularly troubling experience that she was thinking about. It was the emotion that was coming up, welling up because of thinking of this memory. And she said she started feeling really bad, and suddenly she realized that her eyes were darting back and forth very rapidly. And she said that as that happened, she stopped feeling the emotional component of the memory so much. And she thought that was curious. So when she got back home, she tried it with some other memories that brought up some really bad emotions in her. And she started moving her eyes around, as they say in the book, back and forth, hither and thither. Who says hither and thither anymore? It's the 1800s. So moving her eyes around in a strange way. Now, the idea here is that maybe she stumbled upon something. That's not necessarily bad. Lots of times we stumble upon things that, well, not me, I've never stumbled upon anything important, but I teach other people who do, and they stumble upon this and they go, oh, let me take that a little further and see what that's all about, and that's perfectly fine. In fact, we discovered the Purkinje effect that way. We know all kinds of things about rods and cones in the eyes from, you know, phenomenological approach, so it's not bad. What's bad about this is there's nothing else to this, but that hasn't stopped her from making a lot of money and selling a lot of books and training a lot of clinicians in this stuff. In fact, over 30,000 people have been trained in this as their main modality. It's a very successful marketing campaign. The EMDR International Association hold annual conferences that are very successful. Hundreds of attendees come every year. They've started an international aid foundation. A lot of this started in the 1990s because of a news magazine program called 2020, which many of you probably have heard of before. They aired an expose on EMDR, which at the time was fledgling. It was pretty new. It amounted to a primetime commercial for this fledgling group and just rocketed them to stardom. So I'm going to show you a little video clip here, if you'll indulge me, that is a somewhat attenuated version of that video.
Now, the mysterious human mind. We're going to show you an exciting breakthrough, a novel therapy that's being talked about and tried across the country. It's a way for people to free themselves from destructive memories, and it seems to work, even in cases where years of conventional therapy have failed. No one understands exactly why this method succeeds, only that it does. So how does it work? Well, join Lynn Scherr on a fascinating odyssey, The Healing of a Troubled Mind.
You are looking at a radical new form of psychotherapy. The key is the patient's eyes, shifting back and forth in a process that mysteriously unlocks the trauma of times past. Trauma like war. Eric Smith spent only 9 months in Vietnam, but for decades the war tormented him. His body had survived. His mind was something else.
There were 6 incidents in Vietnam with people getting killed. I had decided that had I done more, they wouldn't have gotten killed. Emotionally, I was a mess. I was severely depressed for over 20 years. It was difficult just to get up in the morning and eat, get dressed, and go to work.
Then Eric discovered a new and unique kind of therapy. It's called EMDR, Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. It's being practiced by some 7,000 therapists across the country, and the numbers are growing. It's a combination of traditional talk therapy with something that sounds bizarre. Here's how it works. The therapist rapidly moves his or her fingers, or an object like a wand, before the patient's eyes for several seconds at a time, while the patient talks about an upsetting image. We can't show you the actual hand movements because therapists are concerned that untrained people improperly mimicking the technique might possibly cause harm. But we can give you a pretty good sense of it. This is an actual EMDR session.
Okay.
The therapist who is facing us is about to start.
Okay, just notice that.
The client is dealing with panic attacks. Look at his eyes and watch how they follow the therapist's wand. and how, after he does this for several seconds, he gets very emotional. The procedure is repeated several times in the session, along with more traditional therapy. This eye movement technique was developed by Dr. Francine Shapiro. While on a walk one day, she noticed that when she thought about something disturbing, her eyes moved in a certain way, and then the thought no longer upset her.
Then I started doing it deliberately to see if it would work, and the same thing happened. The thought shifted away, and when I brought it back, it wasn't as disturbing.
If I had seen you that day in the park, what would I have noticed about your eyes?
That they were moving very rapidly in a diagonal, just flickering up and down very, very rapidly. So I thought I stumbled upon some mind process that worked with thoughts. And that's what was so fascinating, because I hadn't been doing it deliberately, but I noticed it happening.
Now, translating this into something you could use on other people, you found what? People's eyes couldn't move that way by instinct or naturally?
Right, and I had to start using my hand to guide them to make similar types of eye movement.
Dr. Shapiro isn't sure why eye movements are effective. Critics have questioned whether EMDR is the snake oil for the 90s, charging that controlled studies are lacking, with no scientific basis to call EMDR an effective innovation. But don't try telling that to Eric Smith. He spent 20 years trying to cope with memories of Vietnam without success. He even considered suicide.
And I decided that night that I had taken lives and that I did not deserve to be here. And I was just tired. I couldn't run anymore.
He was desperate to find something that might relieve his suffering. And despite qualms about trying something that sounded so strange, Eric Smith decided to see Dr. Shapiro and try EMDR.
I thought, what the heck is this going to do? You know, I mean, I've been working hard for years trying to get rid of this stuff with a lot of good people that have a lot of experience. It was sort of difficult to believe or to understand. She started working with me, and I started feeling better, and it would stick. It would stay. I wouldn't, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, stuff wouldn't come back. It wouldn't bother me. I mean, I'd been working on this stuff for years prior to working with her, and within 2 or 3 or 4 sessions, we had resolved issues that I'd been discussing for 4 or 5 years with other people.
Are you concerned that some people will see this as a wonder cure? Is it a quick fix?
No. It goes along. It's hard work. It takes a good amount of clinical skills in order to implement it, and this isn't just touch the person's forehead and they get better.
So this is a good opportunity for me to say I would never want to take away something from a gentleman like this that seems to be working for him. Certainly if he's seen other psychologists and this particular one works for him, then great. However, I think it would be even more cruel if we allowed this to promulgate without asking for some kind of science, because it may not work out for everyone like it did for Eric. In fact, there is no science behind this, and I'll talk to you about that in a moment. First, I'm going to tell you about an equally strange and non-scientific therapeutic realm called TFT, or thought field therapy. If you thought waving a magic wand around in someone's face was odd, wait till you hear this. Formerly called the Callahan technique, named after Roger Callahan, who invented it, thought field therapy presupposes that each of us has around our body a field, an electromagnetic field, okay, that should be detectable, but they say, no, it's not detectable, but it is there. And the reason that you're having psychological or emotional difficulties is because that field is messed up in some way. And the only way to fix it is to disrupt it by a series of tappings on the body, literal tappings. This is to psychology what acupuncture is to medicine. In other words, there are certain supposed meridians. There's no science behind this whatsoever, and I challenge anyone to show me science that actually supports this. Now, I'm going to show you a little video clip next as well, and I have to apologize for the quality, because the woman who made it, she's a practitioner, a new practitioner. She's not a videographer, so she just made this at home. But I think she demonstrates very well what thought field therapy looks like, and then I'll talk to you about the lack of science.
Hello, this is Caterina Flore, founder of Fit for the Top. Thank you for joining me on this personal development journey. The technique for today, it's a very powerful technique for reducing and eliminating anxiety and stress. And it comes from thought field therapy. and technology that has been invented and further developed by Dr. Roger Callahan. Before you start doing the procedure, you tune into that thought that triggers the anxiety in you, and you rate the level of anxiety that you experience on a scale of 0 to 10. 0, there's no anxiety. 10, you experience an intense level of anxiety. The reason for doing this is that you might want to track your progress after doing this technique. So you correct for psychological reversal, and then you do the procedure. I'm going to show you the procedure, then explain it to you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And take a new reading on a scale of 0 to 10. If the level of anxiety is 0, or is to a level that you feel comfortable with, go ahead and do your activities and be much more productive. If not, you might want to repeat the whole procedure again and take a new reading.
Okay. This one's even stranger. However, I have to say, as a caveat, just because something's strange doesn't necessarily mean that there's nothing to it. There's lots of things that, you know, in medicine or even psychotherapy seem strange, but someone might actually benefit from. What I would ask from Francine Shapiro and her 30,000 or so followers is, where's the connection? I want to see some kind of biological connection between the movement of the eyes, which we know comes from the motor cortex, we know where that is, and the emotion centers. I want to see that connection. So far, there's been nothing there. And when they've been asked for it, Francine Shapiro herself said, it doesn't matter. We're not doing that. We're helping people. When Jeffrey Lahr, who's a very well-known psychologist, a few years back in 1999, asked her for further science to back up her claims, she said the following. Eye movement is merely one component of a complex method that combines aspects of many of the major modalities. Remove the eye movement, and there's still a very powerful method. She's even suggesting that there's more to this psychotherapy than just the eye movement. The same thing is true with thought field therapy. It suffers from the same problem that all so-called energy therapies do. You should be able to detect these energy fields first. And from there, you should be able to provide each scientific step after that into the clinical process. They have not done this. In fact, there is no science behind thought field therapy save 4 published articles. 4 in all these years. Only one was in a peer-reviewed journal. And you might think, well, there's one, right? Not so fast. Every single subject was chosen from a group of callers to a talk radio program. That's not science. There's no control group. There's no randomization whatsoever. So why do sometimes people say that they feel better after going through this? Well, I'm glad you asked. Because it turns out they're doing a lot more than moving their eyes around or tapping on their body. I would argue they're engaging in cognitive behavior therapy as well. So if you look at the components here, they involve people in exposure therapy, Socratic dialogue, talk therapy, and also anxiety management. The only thing that they do is add on another component. So my argument would be, why don't you just remove those components and use what we know works? So far, they're not answering. So then we have problems of mainstream psychology as well. Even if you never need to seek out psychotherapy, even if you never take a psychology class, psychology is still going to affect your life. The science of psychology will still affect your life. Some of you may have been looking, for instance, at the therapies I was showing there and thinking, well, what about the placebo effect? After all, if people think they're going to get better, they get better, right? Well, yes and no. If you survey most people, especially people who have never taken a psychology class, what you find is that they really overemphasize the effect of the placebo effect. In fact, the effect is so much smaller that Harriet Hall, the skeptoc, as she calls herself, she suggested that we stop calling it the placebo effect and instead call it the placebo phenomenon, because this is a psychological phenomenon. You don't cure cancer with placebos. You might trick people into thinking that they feel a little better from time to time, but the placebo effect is not nearly as powerful as people sometimes believe or often do. Lie detectors do nothing of the sort. They're polygraphs. They measure more than one biological thing, but you could be feeling fear, rage, embarrassment, or lying, and we would never know the difference on the machine. Eyewitness testimony can be some of the worst testimony ever. Just ask Elizabeth Loftus, who is the top of the game when it comes to things like implanted memory syndrome, or when psychotherapists use hypnotherapy and accidentally call up memories that don't really exist. So eyewitness testimony can really be bad. So that shows you that some of these ideas have sort of moved out into the mainstream and kind of polluted our minds. So we probably want to turn to the science. You will find none here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most mainstream forms of so-called psychotherapy. And let me tell you, let me just pull that back that curtain and let you see the ugly truth behind AA by telling you the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the largest self-help group in human history. It has over 2 million members in 87,000 chapters worldwide. It was founded in the 1930s by these two guys, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, both alcoholics, both quit drinking in 1935 and never touched the stuff again, ostensibly. Like AA itself, Smith and Wilson's sobriety was of a highly religious nature. While undergoing something called the belladonna cure while hospitalized, the belladonna cure is basically poisoning someone. They use mercury, strychnine, and deadly nightshade. And you can imagine there are side effects to that. This was the treatment methodology at the time when people were hospitalized for alcoholism. So Wilson was undergoing this treatment, and he became sicker than he's ever been in his life. And he talks about that in the big book there. And he says that at one point he was so ill, so desperate, in the middle of the night, he just sat up in his bed and he just cried out to no one in particular, if I'll do anything at all, if there be a God, let him show himself now. And he said instantly he saw a bright light in the room with him. And he said he felt this feeling of calm overcome him and this feeling of euphoria and power. And he said he was cured of his alcoholism immediately. And he never drank again. And so he came to believe that God cured him of his alcoholism. So Wilson later on ended up tracking down and meeting Dr. Bob Smith, a very well-known surgeon in his town, very successful, despite the fact that for about 30 years he had been suffering from alcoholism and really struggling and trying everything to overcome it. They hit it off from the start. In fact, the first time they met, they stayed up all night, they say over several pots of coffee that one of their wives kept bringing them, and talking about their treatment, you know, how they had become, you know, alcoholics and how they wanted to get better and they wanted to spread the word. And Wilson told Smith, I believe I have the answer, and I can help you, and you can help me help others, and we'll just spread this word. And so he said, so, Doc, do you know any alcoholics? To which Smith said, are you kidding? I know them all. So they just started collecting them up, and they eventually developed these very well-known 12 steps. Now, it's difficult to look at these 12 steps and understand how AA maintains its position that it is not a religious organization, especially since the word God comes up a lot, or higher power, etc. Now, that doesn't necessarily negate the effectiveness of it. It is ineffective, but doesn't necessarily negate it. The problem for those of us who work within the field of psychology isn't all of the religious part. The problem is this... You click one wrong button with these things. That's where we were, right? The 12 steps and God? Okay, good. You see, that was a sign. You badmouth the big guy and you get it in the... Okay. So it's difficult to understand, as I said, repeating myself, how they maintain that they're not a religious organization, especially since they started out here with the Oxford Group. Now, the Oxford Group was before AA, and it forms the foundation of AA. They ran themselves on something called the 5 C's. And so let me read through these for you. The first couple are not so bad. Confidence, in other words, keep your mouth shut. When you're helping someone who's suffering from alcohol addiction, you don't go around blabbing about their stuff, so they have to have confidence that you'll keep their secrets. Good job. Okay, great. Also, confession, honesty about the real state of a person's life. Nothing wrong with being honest with yourself. Here's where we get into trouble. 3, conviction, the seriousness of his sin and the need to be free of it. You see, the Oxford group believed and taught that alcoholism is a moral failure, that you have failed yourself and God by becoming an addict. And the only way to be free of that is to give yourself over to the higher power. So it's a moral failure. And so we get the 12 steps later on from someone who went through the Oxford group. And what do we have? Powerless over alcohol. Power greater than ourselves to restore us to sanity. Turn your will and your lives over to the care of God. This is not psychotherapy. This is not what we do in the psychotherapeutic realm. We do the exact opposite. We teach people to become self-sufficient. We give them an internal locus of control. We empower them to help themselves. We don't tell them, you're powerless, you're a sinner, you're weak. That's the opposite of what we do. Now, you might think, okay, but does anybody actually benefit from it? Well, yes and no. Depends on the research that you read. If you go back to the 1980s and read Dan Smith's work, you might be fooled into thinking they have pretty good numbers. I mean, he did a survey in which he took 78 women and 137 men, and he found 79% success rate and 61% success rate compared, respectively, compared to a control group of 3 and 5% respectively. So it looks really good. Until about a decade later, when they came along and looked at it more closely, and they found that actually this was not a study of Alcoholics Anonymous. This was a study of patients who were undergoing a comprehensive treatment program that involved a lot of other psychotherapy as well as Alcoholics Anonymous. So what does AA do? Well, you probably already know about the 12 steps. You're supposed to go to 90 meetings in 90 days at the very beginning. Guess how many do that? Almost nobody. It turns out that 50% quit within the first few months and 90% quit within the first year. So at best, they have a 5 to 10% success rate. And success is loose. It's very difficult to study Alcoholics Anonymous because, number one, it's anonymous. And number two, it's a self-selected group. And number three, you're supposed to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, but no one's tracking you because you're on your own. Strangely, you don't have any control over your behavior, but you're on your own. And so there's really nobody to track this. It's very difficult to study it. There's also a very flat hierarchical structure in AA. There's only one group above the membership, just one. So it's difficult to study this in any scientific way. Later on in the year 2000, there was a group that did that, led by a guy named Tonengan. And what he found was not particularly surprising. He said that the treatment outcome was significantly tied, a positive treatment outcome, to one thing only, the client's ratings of the conceptual and spiritual underpinnings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it seems to be suggesting that if you're a spiritual person, you may be in that 3 to 5% who actually benefit. But if you're not a spiritual or religious person, what do you do? What can you do? There are actually many cases where judges have sentenced people to go to Alcoholics Anonymous rather than prison, and they're basically sentencing them to a religious organization, and we do nothing about it. Of course, there are groups that are non-spiritual, and there are also people who quit on their own with social support. And I'm going to show you a video clip of one of them. She's a friend of mine, but her name is Ellen Beth.
For 23 years, I heard from, I don't know, countless people that if you don't find God, you will not stay sober. If you do not find God, then you are not recovered. I was raised by a conservative Jewish family, and I was expected to do the bat mitzvah bit, and I was sent to Hebrew school, and didn't really get into it, and I cut as often as possible. Once I rebelled against my parents and Judaism, it wasn't so much as that I really thought too much about religion at that point. I was into my own little world and universe and had problems with alcohol. And when you have problems with alcohol, there's only really one place to turn, and that's AA. And when you turn to AA, you have to turn to God. Over and over, I was told that if you are not spiritual, you are not sober. So for a very long time, I outright lied. I told them I believed in God. I told them I was spiritual. I told them that I was doing the steps. And I felt like the biggest fraud. What I saw in AA is people being told that they have to surrender to win, that they are powerless over their own choices, that they have to turn their will and their life over the care of God as they understand Him, that they are not responsible for what happens in their own life. And I see that as incredibly damaging. What I do is I take full responsibility for my own sobriety. On February 24th, I will be sober 26 years without the help of any God.
She's a strong woman. Now, I would never, once again, want to take Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or something away from someone who's succeeding there. That's not my message today. My message is we need to look at this scientifically and find out if this is the best option. And that if it's the most ubiquitous option we can use. And the answer, according to the research, is definitely no. So when I first decided to give this talk, and I was putting it together, I spoke to some colleagues, some of them prominent psychologists and fellow skeptics, and their feelings about this last category were mixed. Some of them thought that it didn't really fit within a talk on pseudoscience. And then others saw where I was going with it and shared my feeling that this is potentially the most damaging area of all. I'm referring to bad teaching as a form of pseudoscience. Psychology is rife with examples of controversial people and subjects and studies. I mean, we could talk all day about the Stanford Prison Experiment, 1971, Phil Zimbardo out at Stanford University built a fake prison in the basement of the psych lab and imprisoned a couple dozen kids, sort of. It's not good science. It just isn't. It's in every psychology textbook. Like, you flip open to social psychology, there's Zimbardo, you know, looking like a magician with the mustache and all that, and like smiling and making money. And this wasn't even published in a peer-reviewed journal, as a matter of fact. It was published in a science magazine because it couldn't get into a peer-reviewed journal. So a lot of Psych 101 students don't come away knowing that mommy and daddy are fighting behind the scenes about this study. Sigmund Freud, quack. You know, he had a lot of wacko things to say about sexuality. He had a really insulting things to say about women. There's no science there. However, there's a lot of science here. Now, I will tell you ahead of time that this Milgram obedience study I'm going to tell you about now is one of the most unethical studies ever done in the history of psychology, and that's saying something. Stanley Milgram, back in the early 1960s, was teaching at Yale University, and he put an ad in local newspapers offering $4.50, and that was about 35, 40 bucks in today's money, for those willing to take part in a study at Yale University. When they arrived, they were greeted by a researcher, at least he looked like a researcher. He's in a white lab coat. There's actually a really powerful effect of the lab coat. We call it the lab coat effect. People actually do better on their medication if it's prescribed to them by a person in a white lab coat. It's crazy. So he's an authority figure already because he's wearing a white lab coat. And when you come in as a subject, there's already someone in the waiting room. Can I just spoil you all for psychological studies right now and let you know there's never a waiting room? You're being studied. The moment you walk in, if you think you're in a waiting room, it's not a waiting room. And probably if there's another subject there, he's not a subject. he's a confederate, we call him. He's working for the researcher. And that was the case here. So you see the guy seated there. He was a hired actor. So he was hired by Milgram. So was this young high school history teacher to pretend to be a person in charge of the study. And the only real subjects are like that schlub there who's helping to strap this guy into an electric chair. They're told that this is a study on pain and memory. It's nothing of the sort. This is a study of obedience. Because what Milgram wanted to know was, right, a hiccup after World War II, could that happen here? Could one man have that much control over us? The attitude at the time tended to be, no, we're Americans. That could never happen here. That was Germans. What are you going to do? Milgram suspected otherwise, and so he decided to do this highly unethical study, where he would take the real subject into another room and say, you're going to be the teacher, and we just strapped a learner into the electric chair with some electrode paste around the wrists, etc. Oh, I forgot to mention, the guy being strapped in has some scripted dialogue. He says he has a heart condition. Who would electrocute someone with a heart condition? Turns out everybody. All you have to do is have the conditions just right. So the subject's taken into the room, put in front of this fake machine. No one's actually being electrocuted at all. What begins is a recording of the man in the other room. And in case you don't understand the voltage that's on there that goes from 15 volts up to 450 volts, they put words there as well, like slight and extreme, all the way up to three X's at the end. So you get it. So they put people in front of this machine, and they were told, read through this list of word pairs, and then quiz the guy on them. Here's the quiz. And so it's like, big, is that house, rock, car, or dog? And then you wait for the answer through the speaker. And if the guy gives the right answer, you say, correct, and you move on to the next one. If he gets an answer wrong, throw a switch. Start at 15 and then move all the way to the end. So the question is, who would ever do that? That's crazy. Again, everyone. There was not a single person who didn't throw a switch. Yeah. So let me just show you a little introduction to this where, oh, by the way, we have the film. Because Milgram was even astounded by how successful this was. He brought in a film crew on the last day. And the last few subjects, he filmed them. So we know that it happened and no one can question him. So I'll talk to you about how this is not pseudoscience, but it gets taught in a pseudoscientific way after you watch the little video clip.
Going along to get along is one thing, but what if you were ordered to conform and do something against your better nature? Obedience to authority is another kind of conformity, and 35 years ago it was tested to its limits in science's most controversial and shocking conformity experiment ever.
Let me out of here. You have no right to keep me here. Let me out. Let me out of here. Let me out.
Continue, please.
It's called the Milgram Obedience Study. And what you're about to see has rarely been seen on network television. Here at Yale University in the early 1960s, psychology professor Stanley Milgram wondered whether the Holocaust was a uniquely German experience, or under similar circumstances, would any one of us have the same capacity for evil? Here's how the Milgram experiment worked. Subjects like this man were told they were part of a study on memory and punishment. Punishment they would deliver to this man from this ominous-looking machine.
This machine generates electric shocks.
The subjects were told they'd have to give the man shocks after every wrong answer in the memory test, and the voltage would increase from slight at 15 to intense at 255 to the unimaginable at 450. But what the subjects didn't know was that the machine wasn't real, and it wasn't a memory test at all. It was a test of obedience, to see if everyday people would inflict pain on others just because an authority figure told them to.
You want to step right in here, Lou?
The subjects also didn't know that these two people, the man in the lab coat who was running the experiment and the man receiving the shocks, were Milgram accomplices. The man in the lab coat, really a young high school teacher, gained instant credibility with subjects he had never met before, simply by acting in charge and sounding and looking like a scientist.
And this electrode paste is to provide a good contact to avoid any blister or burn.
And there was more scripted dialogue, always with the subjects listening in, that raised the stakes even higher.
About 2 years ago, I was in the Veterans Hospital, and while there, they detected a heart condition.
So now, Dr. Milgram had set up a crisis of conscience, pitting fear of harming someone against orders to obey.
My role was to give commands to the subjects to get them to go to the end of the machine.
The man in the lab coat, John Williams, 35 years later.
When you first saw that machine, did it ever occur to you that someone would go to the very end?
No.
This one will be 195 volts. Oh. The correct one.
Let me out of here.
Slow. Dance.
Let me out of here. My heart's bothering me. Let me out of here. You have no right to keep me here. Let me out.
195 volts. Anguish cries to stop. And they're not the first pleas for help.
By this time, the subject believes he has shocked the man with the phony heart condition 13 times.
Let me out of here. Let me out.
Continue, please.
Let me out of here. My eyes bother me.
Go on.
Let me out. Let me out.
Let's look at that again. And this time, pay attention to the subject's struggle as he feels the weight of his conscience.
Let me out of here. My eyes bother me. Let me out of here. You have no right to keep me here. Let me out.
He looks back to the authority figure, John Williams, for relief, but doesn't get it.
Let me out.
Continue, please.
Let me out of here. My eyes bother me.
Go on.
Let me out.
But instead of walking away, he tells Williams he won't be responsible, allowing him to feel less guilty, yet still obey.
That is incorrect. This will be at 3:30. The correct phrase is rich boy.
Let me out of here. My eyes bother me. Let me out, I tell you. Let me out of here. Let me out of here. You have no right to hold me here.
The next phrase is fast.
Let me out. Let me out. Let me out of here. Let me
bird,
out. Let me
car,
out.
Train, plane.
Silence. Is the man unconscious? Dead? Why won't the subject just stop?
Continue.
Because of the commands to obey.
That is incorrect. This will be 3:45.
More silence. Putting even more pressure on the subject. Should he follow more commands, or finally, follow his conscience?
I'm not going to go any further.
It's absolutely essential that you continue.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it, though.
You had no other choice.
I don't have a choice. I'm not going to go ahead with it.
This subject finally stopped, but only after blood-curdling screams and deadly silence. In all, he made the decision to inflict pain on a fellow human being 23 different times. But that subject didn't go as far as most. Amazingly, nearly two-thirds of Milgram subjects, from a laborer to a social worker to a corporate executive, went all the way. That surprised Milgram and dozens of psychiatrists who had predicted that only one in 1,000 would obey to the very end. Which on this Milgram shock machine is past intense, past danger, all the way to a place seemingly too painful and perilous for words.
That's disturbing.
We thought so. I thought so.
And so did Stanley Milgram, who was so worried that no one would believe his results that he filmed the study on the very last day as proof. Proof, he concluded, that just like in Nazi Germany, any one of us could put blind obedience over conscience.
So that's a disturbing study from the history of psychology. It's not replicable. The reason is because this study made such headlines and because the American Psychological Association took a look at this one and then later on in the early 70s, Zimbardo's prison study at Stanford and put the clamps down. And now we have these institutional review boards that you have to take proposals to first, and they're much stricter than they used to be. So just want to let you know that this won't be done anymore. It's unethical, and you can probably understand why. Even though no one was being electrocuted, that's not the reason it's banned. It's because you don't have the right to do that to someone just for science. And I say, I don't say just for science lightly. It's the cost-benefit issue where these people now have to live with the knowledge, not guessing like you and I, but the knowledge that they would kill someone just because someone in a lab coat told them to. So I just want to get that out of the way. Now, I don't include this in my talk because this is pseudoscience. Instead, I include it in my talk because I'm so enraged that people are teaching it wrong. In fact, I don't even have to guess at this. I actually did a survey online in 2005 in which I sent out an email with the survey attached to it to many, many psychology professors, high school, college, and university professors across the country. I ended up getting 150 responses, which I thought was pretty darn good. 150 usable responses. This was a sample of high school and college psychology teachers. I included questions, and in some cases statements, is this true or false, very simple stuff, about classics in the field of psychology. The Milgram one was a dismal failure. 53%, more than half of the people teaching this study to fresh young minds, agreed with this statement, and it's absolutely false. Milgram showed that it is relatively easy to get people to obey orders to hurt someone. He absolutely did not show that. And then nearly a quarter of them agreed that Milgram showed that most people have an inherent bad side that can lead them to dangerous behaviors. That was not the consequence of this study whatsoever. In fact, Milgram took great pains in not just this study, which was only a study of 40 people, but over a 10-year period, he did numerous studies that included 780 people altogether, and he altered every possible component within this study to find the perfect, the ideal situation in which you could get that 63% or so compliance rate. So, for instance, when the learner was in the other room, as you just saw, you can hear him, but he's in the other room, he got that 65% of people that go to the end of the machine. It's 100% of people who threw switches. 65% went to the end of the machine, and not happily. You saw that. Stressfully, etc. So they're really grappling with this. Now, if he put the learner in the other room and you couldn't hear him, it jumps up to 75%. So it's not easy to do this. It's actually got to be just the right situation. Also, if the learner was in the same room within a few feet, it dropped down to 40%. And if the learner was in the same room as you and you actually had to put his hand on the hot plate, as you see here, it drops down to 30%. So environmental factors have to be just right. Also, group dynamics. He hired Confederates to come in and disagree with whether or not they should. They were pretending to be subjects as well, and they would disagree as to whether or not they should throw a switch. It dropped to only 10% obedience. If the proximity of the authority figure is also important, the person has to be in the room eyeballing you and giving you the orders. Otherwise, you get very low success rates. And also, this one's very curious to me, if there's two white lab-coated guys and they're giving contradictory orders to you, no one complies. They all stop. Isn't that interesting? So he took great pains to try to teach us that it's very difficult to get just the right circumstances, to get people to do these things, and it's in all of us. The potential for greatness is in each of us, and the potential for really what you might call evil behavior is within each of us. It's the situation, more than we would like to think, coincidence, that deems whether or not we'll show one side of the coin or the other. That's the lesson. And what frightens me is that this is getting taught to people so incorrectly. And I suspect I know why. I think a majority of these teachers are reading the paragraph or two in the textbook, and they've never actually read the study itself. They've never actually read these classics that these people took such great pains to publish for us to read. And as a result of that, it's the blind leading the blind. Now, I know that there are many exceptions, and I know that this 150 so people who responded, you know, they're not necessarily representative, but it frightens me that anybody would be teaching this at a high school or college incorrectly. What I generally find, by the way, and this is going to sound really arrogant, so I apologize up front, but I like to have students who have never taken a psychology class. I want a blank slate, because I find that, as my mama says, it's easier to plant a seed if you don't have to weed first. So if there's a lot of stuff in there that's incorrect, and you don't have to go, oh, no, forget that, but no, that's not right. That's a real task for students. They've been led down the wrong path. Then they got to do a lot of backtracking, et cetera. It's better just to have fresh, new minds and say, let me just teach it to you right. I told you it sounds really arrogant. I'm sorry, but I do know this stuff. Now, I don't expect every person who teaches psychology to know in intimate detail every single study that they're talking about, but I would at least expect them to go beyond the textbook. And I would hope that in the future, the same is true of clinicians, that they ask for more science and that they read the science more than they're currently doing. And I hope that in the future, there's none of this stuff and I can't even give this talk anymore. That's my hope, but I ain't holding my breath. Thank you for your kind indulgence. Sure. I'll just plug my website and my podcast.
The AV guy showed me where the mic was. He didn't show me how to turn it on.
Oh, so. No, you can just hand it
okay.
to people.
Yes, yeah. Sir.
All right, so wasn't the Zimbardo experiment in the 70s or something?
71.
Like? So it's now 40-some-odd years later. Zimbardo is still at Stanford. What is he?
He's retired.
Retired.
Yeah, he's emeritus, yeah.
Yeah, he's written a couple other books, done a couple other studies and things. But what does he have to say about that prison study today?
Oh, he's in love with it. Yeah, he's made a lot of money from it. which isn't necessarily bad. I hope you all make a lot of money. But yeah, he's milking it. But he wrote a book called The Lucifer Effect recently, in which he compares the Stanford prison study to the horrible atrocities that happened at Abu Ghraib prison. It's not an easy read, and if you're particularly sensitive to human suffering, you don't want to get a copy of this book because there's images in there that are really grotesque. But it is interesting that when you look at them side by side, they almost look like they were taken the same day, the ones from his study and the one from Abu Ghraib. They're really shocking, but doesn't make it good science.
By the way, I'd like to point out that the Psychology Forum hosted Dr. Zimbardo here when that book first came out.
And nothing that I'm saying is representative of this organization. Yes, it's all on me.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It was very enlightening.
Thank you.
Could you tell us your opinion of Bill Miller and motivational interviewing, Marshall Linehan and dialectical behavioral therapy?
I have to tell you, I don't know a dang thing about it.
Okay.
No. Do you have an opinion about it?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. Well, you don't have to share it. I was just going to give you the floor.
What?
No, he's not going to share it. Okay.
Not tonight.
Not tonight. Okay. Do you have an opinion, Dr.
I do,
Riley?
But I'm a clinical psychologist, okay. And I'm going to pass on that question because okay. I'm not the speaker. Yes, ma'am.
How do you feel about the humanistic psychology that was there in the 60s and also the Martin Seligman work on happiness and positive psychology today?
Learned helplessness and all that. So your first question, humanistic psychology, I think it's wonderful. I think the best thing that Carl Rogers introduced to psychotherapy is this client-centered approach where, and Freud would have hated it, but he saw us all as sick, that's why he called us patients, and now you're a client and you're working on a problem together, and the idea is, I don't know how to fix you, you do, and so I'm going to help you do that, and I'm going to set boundaries for you. I love that idea. I think it's really solid. And the thing about learned helplessness, I think there's really solid science there, too. Yeah. So he did these studies with German shepherds where there was an electrified cage and they could be taught to jump from one side to the other to avoid the electrification. Again, we don't do this stuff anymore. There's really strict guidelines for animals and housing them and all that stuff, especially dogs and higher order primates and things like that. So it's, you know, sometimes reading this stuff is like very difficult. But we did learn a lot from that. And he found out that the dogs that were taught to jump from one side to the other to avoid electrification, when they heard the buzzer, they would jump. But then there were some that it didn't matter which side of the cage they jumped to, they would still get electric shocked. And then even after they tried to teach those animals to avoid the electric shock, they wouldn't move. And they would drag them over to the other side, like trying to show them, look, if you're over here, you won't get shocked. And they just laid there. And so this idea of learned helplessness, that in their recent past, they had tried to help themselves and failed so often that they just stopped trying. And the direct application of this that some friends of mine use is talking about, spousal abuse. And so sometimes people will say, well, they just go right back to them. They must want it, you know. No, that's not it. It's that they've tried in the past to get away from this situation and failed. And as a result of that, they might give up. And that's what concerns me about this locus of control issue with AA, is it directly feeds into that research where if you're teaching people to have an external locus of control, you're teaching them that the world is chaotic and that something else is in control of their fate. And that's not what that's not the psychology I signed up for. Psychotherapy should be empowering people, not taking the power away from them. That's something else.
Okay.
So I'm especially interested in the Milgram studies, and I'm not sure that the textbook is so wrong. So let me sort of defend it and also make another point.
Oh, which one?
So the textbook account is like people can be really bad, even if it's a respectable Yale undergraduate or whatever. I think the studies show that with appropriate experimental manipulations, people can be made to do things that they wouldn't otherwise have imagined themselves in their normal life to do.
Sure.
And I think that take-home is really important and
Absolutely.
Helps set the framework for findings like that recently from Canadian hospitals about residents who perpetrated medical errors under instructions from their clinical supervisors and didn't do anything about it and why they didn't do about it, et cetera. And that's a really interesting study.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of pushing back on maybe the teaching wasn't so bad.
I think we're on the same page here, so maybe I wasn't clear about what I was critiquing. Yeah. the critique that I have isn't that, you know, under the right experimental conditions, you can get people to do really bad things. That's not, I totally agree with that. The critique that I have is that people seem to come away from this often thinking that it's easy to do that. And that's not correct. And Milgram never said that. In fact, he took great pains to say the opposite of that.
We're in accord on that point, and I'll add two pieces of color. The first is I've met someone who was one of the actors who said to the subjects, the experiment must continue. And he's a particularly strong voice and strong personality, and he had a much better compliance rate than others. So there's some variables that are hard to... He's proud of that. And even though he's a beloved friend, I think one of the key findings of... One of the key inferences from Milgram's studies is that it's very easy to get research assistants at Yale University to do unethical experiments.
Can you just all remember that he said that?
Yes. Does anybody have any?
I don't necessarily disagree. I just don't have anything to back it up.
I didn't see you back here.
Yeah, my understanding is that Philip Zimbardo aborted his study when he saw the effect that it had on people.
Okay, continue, and I'm going to tell you why he aborted it.
Well, I know why.
Do you know why?
Because one of his students said this is not a good thing to be
doing. Yeah, one of his students said he was dating that he later married.
Yes,
she turned to him and said, we're not dating anymore, and then he took it seriously.
Well, my point is, though, that he's used that, from my understanding, as a way to say this is not something you can do. This was something we did. We were experimenting. We were looking at the Holocaust. We were looking to find ways to, you know, explore people's personalities.
Yeah.
So I didn't see that, at least from my understanding.
You didn't see what?
That the studies that they were put out there as a way to say this is what you're saying. What I take it what you were saying is that it's getting into the textbooks.
Oh, Zimbardo's study is in the textbook. But I'm saying it's bad science.
But not in the way. What I've read is that he has been, and he himself has said that's not a good thing to do. Anyway.
Well, he said that component was a mistake, absolutely, but he stands by his study as being scientific.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's been very open, by the way, I should say, about the fact that he was completely caught up in it and should have ended it much earlier. You're right. Yeah.
I'd like to hear a comment on us sitting here fairly dispassionately discussing this and even chuckling at some of the lighter aspects of it.
Okay, well, thank you. Of course you can.
Hello. I was going to ask you, I thought there had been some, on the aromatherapy thing, I thought there had been some studies or something about looking at the areas of the brain that light up and particular areas that are maybe, I don't know, dopamine receptors or something. I'm not quite sure what I'm talking about. But I thought there had been some actual legitimate studies on that.
Oh, well, send me a link. That's all I can say. I'd love to take a look at it. I will say that my friend Carol Tavares, who's a very well-known social psychologist, she tells us to be very careful of studies having pretty pictures in them these days of brains, because we get really impressed by those because they have areas that light up, and then we're like, oh, it lit up. And then she's like, well, what does that mean? So there may be something that you've seen. I don't know, but I haven't seen it. I've looked pretty deep. But yeah, well, listen, I make homemade soaps, and they smell. You know why, though? You don't care, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Because years ago, someone said something to me about soap, and I kind of went, I don't even know what soap's made out of. And I'm a grown man. And I just thought, that's so ridiculous. So I decided I was going to find out. And then I found out there's like whole communities that make handmade soap. And so I just started buying stuff. And now I make handmade soap, and it's lovely. It's wonderful. And I get migraines. That's why I'm not indulging in the wine back there, because it's one of my triggers. But I get migraines from a lot of different scents. And so I have to be very careful about the things that I use and the products and et cetera. And so I can make my own now. And it smells really good, and it puts me in a good mood to smell really nice things. But again, as a therapy, I'm going to need to see a lot of really solid science, and I don't see that. Sorry. Okay, I've talked too much. That's why I'm sorry.
In regard to some of these studies that were done, do you have any comment on sort of the mass psychology of, say, people who lived in Germany during World War II and refused to acknowledge things that were going on within their communities and how they were able to sort of block that out?
It's fascinating stuff. Yeah, I don't really have a whole lot to say that because that's not my area. But I do have a very good friend. Her name is Magda Brown, and she's a Holocaust survivor. And she's taught me an awful lot about forgiveness. And, you know, it's How anyone can go through that as she did, starting as a 16-year-old girl, come out the other side of it having lost her entire family and still be a wonderful, lovely person and forgive an entire nation, that's beyond me. I don't know if I have that in me. So I'm fascinated by, like you said, the denial and the blocking and all that stuff, and also the governmental reaction now, which is no free speech about the Holocaust and all that stuff. But I'm also fascinated by the positive side of it, and I think, you know, that's where I concentrated my efforts.
Hi. You've said a number of times that you're not against therapies that work, even if they're not scientific.
Let me correct you on that.
Okay.
No, I would never want to take something away from the people that we saw here if it's working right for them already. But I'm never going to say that I'm a proponent of something just because some people say it works. That's different.
Okay. My real part of the question is, this may sound silly, is there any real evidence or any statistical comparison of how many people feel they've been helped by scientific versus unscientific therapies?
Well, scientific is a huge group, and unscientific is an even bigger group.
Okay.
But I will tell you that people who go to psychotherapy get better more often. They
okay.
get better faster, and the ride is a lot easier.
Okay. Better percentages.
Well, thank
yeah.
you.
But that's a broad general statement.
And so. Professor Helms, I want to thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, by the way, I've just passed this on because I've actually gone to his website multiple times. It's remarkably entertaining. His podcasts are great, and they're available there as well. So thank you, Dr.
Thank
Helms.
Thank you. Thanks, sir. Thanks, everybody.